Swillians, if you love and respect your surfboards, and I'm talking pure love, then you must protect them. And nobody protects surfboards better than the official hardware and accessories partner of all Swillians, Ocean and Earth. Doesn't matter what you kick, shorties, fishes, logs, sups, O&E have over 30 different types of board covers to keep your precious protected. Day sleeves, travel covers, singles, doubles, coffins, wheels. These board bags are light, functional, and built to last. Good enough for Owen Wright. It's good enough for Ryan Callanan. It's good enough for Tyler Wright. You know it's primo gear. And it's one of those presents you just never see coming. Imagine getting an O&E board bag in your Chrissy windsock. Mad. Go to oceanandearth.com to scope the whole range today.
Ain't That Swell presents Core Lords.
Today we're joined by Californian former World Tour surfer and Final Five contender Connor Coffin. I first met Connor as a 15-year-old on a stab trip I put together with a 11 or 12-year-old Jack Robinson, a 16-year-old Kiowa Belly, and a 14-year-old Ian Gentile. We went to the Mentawai and Tello Islands, and man, was I shocked by the maturity and power of Connor's surfing. It was bizarre. The bastard child of his Santa Barbara heroes Tom Curran and Dane Reynolds, he was ripping off the severest of severe man turns, attacking the most cupped out critical sections and transitioning seamlessly out of full attack mode with perfect style and technique. It was some of the most beautiful surfing I'd ever seen up until that point in the flesh, aggressive yet fluent and smooth at the same time. No surprise then that he went on to scale the heights of the World Tour, culminating in a showing at the WSL Final Five Showdown at Trestles, where he narrowly lost out to Philippe Toledo, finishing fourth in the world. Then, a few months later, he was gone, unceremoniously dumped from the World Tour at the mid-year cut, along with top five contender Morgan Siblik, neither of them to return. We spoke about the cut. We spoke about realizing his long-awaited and long-predicted, by me that is, free surfing ambitions. We spoke about the recent Fiji swell he and his brother Parker took on, and much, much more. Do not forget how good Connor Coffin's surfing is. Go back and watch Highline, his J-Bay masterpiece. Stay tuned for his section in the upcoming Snapped 5 feature film, and pay attention to this next chapter of his career, because I'm calling, you're going to see some of the most modern and stylish lines imaginable.
Fucking good, man. Good. So good to see your head.
I know. Likewise. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Oh, mate.
What's going on?
Not much. I'm just watching this Challenger Series event, which, I'm sure you're. Are you watching this thing, or do you just keep your head in the sand now that you're out of that world?
No, I watch sometimes, but I haven't been watching just now. Yeah. It looks like the waves have been super fun the last few days, though.
Mate, it's been really fun and a really entertaining event, and just a lot more entertaining than anything I've seen on the World Tour in the last few stops, that's for sure. Just the wave quality's improved, and those four-man heats, as torturous as they are to surf in, man, they're a good spectacle. It's just constant waves being ridden on a fucking eight-second period swell, so there's kind of non-stop waves and just a lot of action, a lot of buzzer beaters. Yeah.
Heck yeah. I know. Everyone's surfing. There's so many good surfers in it.
Man. But we're recording, so I'll just get straight into it because we're here to celebrate your career, dude, and your life.
Thanks,
Dad. Oh, dude. It was a stellar career. I mean, it's still going in a sense, but obviously you've stepped away from competing and, obviously we met when you were really young, 15, and I remember at the time thinking, wow, you're going to have to choose here between a World Tour career and a free surfing career. And you kind of had a foot in both corners, but ultimately kind of more committed to the competitive side of things, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely like to think that my surf career is far from over at this point. And kind of going back into the more just free surfing mode and walking away from the contest. But yeah, I definitely made that decision at one point. I was trying to do free, like be more of a free surfer, and then I was competing still, and it was just really hard to do both. Like, but I was really got super fortunate to be on so many good trips, you know, through Surfing Mag, like that trip we went on. And, you know, that was kind of the first big trip I ever got to do, that one to Indo. And then, you know, that led to getting to do trips for Kai's Movies and just getting to surf with so many amazing surfers. And I was so many just epic times on the road with all those guys. And then, yeah, I guess it kind of shifted into competing more because it just felt really hard to do both. And I wasn't making heats, and I was like, well, I really want to try to make the tour. So once I committed to that, and then I got on the tour, then it felt like just boom. It was like 7 years later. I was like, wow, where'd those 7 years go? Went by so quick. And yeah, here I am. Now I'm back on the other side of things.
It's good to hear, man. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I read something somewhere saying that you'd stepped away from pro surfing, or you'd retired or something. Obviously, that wasn't accurate. And I mean, a guy with as pure a style as yours is never obviously going to retire from elite surfing. People are going to want to shoot your surfing, watch your surfing for a long time to come. And I mean, the proof of that was in that recent strike to Fiji, man, with your brother Parker. And yeah, I mean, even as a 15-year-old on that stab trip, like your backside tube riding was super committed, super psycho, super mature for your age. But yeah, talk to us about that trip, man. Going to Fiji, yeah, with Parker. Holy shitballs, it was big.
Oh yeah, that was so fun. I mean, I think that was just some of the things that I missed being able to do while being on the tour. You know, you have to be so focused now, especially like with the way they've structured it all in the mid-year cut. And if you don't make that, then you're straight on the challengers, and just the level is getting higher and higher. So you're so committed to competing that I think I missed being able to do, you know, like go chase swells and work on other projects and just, you know, all the other things that I love about surfing. And I think I got to the point where I was like, okay, cool. I feel like I've satisfied like the competitive sort of itch that I had, you know, as a kid, and like that dream of being on the tour and getting to compete at that level. So yeah, to like kind of hang up competing last August, it was funny. Everyone was like, yeah, you're retired. Like, so you're retired. I'm like, no, I'm not fucking retired. Like, I'm just not surfing in contests anymore. Right. Like, what the?
Good to clarify that. Yeah.
Like, I think it's so funny, like, that everyone thinks that just because you don't surf in contests anymore, you're retired. I'm like, well, yeah, I guess if you're like, you know, if you really kill it, and you're 36 and you know, you don't need to work anymore or something, maybe you could qualify that as retiring. But I'm like so far from that, and I love to surf. And so yeah, to like go from that and then get to cherry pick a swell and score that hard with my brother and like such an epic crew was just, I mean, that was like the other spectrum of dream come true, you know? So yeah, I felt so lucky to be there, and hopefully I can make a few more of those sessions happen at different places around the world in the next couple of years.
It was instant validation of your decision to walk away from the world tour. And man, your world tour career was amazing. Like, you surfed for a world title in, what was that, 21 or something, Gala, at that Trestles Final Five scenario. And I was looking at some of your results too, like even early on in your career. I think it was in your debut year, like maybe second or third event, you made the quarters or semis against Mick Fanning at Bells, like got a fifth, like crazy results straight off the bat. And 7 years on tour, as they say, you know, life moves in 7 year increments.
No way, I've never heard that.
Yeah, there's in fact this amazing documentary series called Seven Up, where they basically chart people's lives from across the social classes in the UK, and they revisit them every 7 years to see how things are progressing. It's an incredible concept. But mate, you wrap up the tour, you go to Fiji, you absolutely score. And now, so what are some of the other planned spots, or, you know, where do you really want to score, and what are some of the goals in this next chapter?
Gosh, it's such a good question. I think I'm still sort of figuring it out. I guess right now I've just been, focusing on two things. I'm going to have a part in the Snap 5 movie with my brother, but like, he's been working on that the last couple of years. So It was rad to kind of jump on that with him and get to do some trips and film for whether it ends up being like a, you know, a shorter part or a full part. I'm excited about that. And the reason it would be shorter is because I'm having a kid in June. So I'm
Congratulations
on that. Yeah, thanks. And I mean, that was always like, I've always wanted to have kids, and just, you know, the timing sort of worked right that I was, when I got off tour, that it worked out. And I was like, you know, I'm stoked. Like, my partner was always like, well, you could have kids and do the tour and all that. And I was like, yeah, for sure. I know we could. But I think there was a big part of me that really wanted to be able to be home and like focus on, once I have a kid, like being there for them as much as I could. So, you know, I think that would be a lot harder traveling and doing the tour. But, you know, guys like Parco have done it since they were 21 and have done an amazing job of having a family. So it can be done. But yeah, so I guess those two things are sort of where my mind's at in the next few months for sure. Other places I want to score. I really want to go back to J-Bay and get that really good outside of an event. Just, that's one of my favorite waves in the world. And
Man, how good was your section? Highline, was it?
Yeah, that was a film my brother and I made.
Holy shit. Some of the best tracks have ever been laid down on that wave for sure.
Oh, thanks, dude. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, just going to those places, I didn't give up on airs, but I still like to try them. But, you know, as far as my surfing, I just really want to focus on, you know, like power surfing and just trying to get better at that. And, you know, that obviously includes lots of other things, but just that's my favorite type of surfing to do. So I really just want to hone in on that from, you know, boards and all that, and just try to, you know, kind of leave my mark as I can as a power surfer at today's day and age. So I feel like J-Bay is one of the best waves to do that. And, you know, other places like that, I really want to just try to get off the grid too and find some lesser known waves and surf some big waves too. That was something I always wanted to get into when I was younger. And I felt like before I got on tour, I never really had the chance to, you know, figure out the big wave thing. And then once I was on tour, I was more focused on that. Didn't want to get hurt doing, you know, big wave stuff. So I might kind of dip my toes in there and see how I like it. The cloud break thing was kind of the best of both worlds. I was joking with Soli actually that day because he was kind of saying the same. He's like, I don't really do the big wave thing, but if it's a big wave and you can get barreled, that's cool. So I think that's kind of where my head's at. Like, I like big barrels. So definitely want to try to surf some bigger tubes. Maybe Ireland seems like everyone's been scoring down there. That's somewhere I always wanted to go. And a bunch of people have been going the last couple of years, but yeah, try to find some big barrels.
Sick, man. Yeah, you must get some inspiration from Parker. He's a maniac at Pipeline in particular, and kind of any big hollow left and right for that matter. But yeah, I mean, how much have you gained from watching his growth as a surfer? He's come on so strong in the last few years.
Oh yeah, totally. He's just been so, you know, I think he was kind of doing the same. He was a little bit in one, trying to compete, but also be a free surfer. Then he kind of committed to competing, and then he just decided this isn't for me. I love surfing. I want to focus on doing this. And since he made that conscious decision and just started putting all his effort into that, like, his surfing's gotten so much better, and he's stoked, and he works really hard at it and loves, I mean, he's one of the biggest frothers as far as surf technique and stuff goes. So when we get together and we're both just bouncing ideas off each other and talking about everything, surfing, boards, and, you know, technique and everything. And then we love to surf together and push each other in the water still. So it's super fun. And it's been awesome to see what he's been able to do the last couple of years. And, you know, I'm stoked to get to do some more trips with him and more projects with him for sure.
Man, that's actually a really exciting new chapter now I think about it. You know, you and your brother bouncing ideas off each other and just getting deep into the technical aspects of riding waves of consequence, and then other waves that really suit your surfing. I like when people lean into their strengths too. Like there seems to be more space for that in the free surfing realm, where, you know, you can just go to the waves that suit your surfing, and like, as a spectator, that's actually really what I want to see. You know, I want to see you at Morocco or South Africa, or you know, Mulligmore or Cloudbreak, like, you know, some of these really perfect hollow waves that suit like a technique and style as pure as yours. But yeah, back to Fiji, man, like, talk to us about the day. Like, you know, can you paint the scene for us what it's like pulling up to Cloudbreak on a day like that?
For sure. It was pretty interesting because that swell, I mean, I've been super fortunate enough to spend a lot of time down there. And so I've watched a lot of swells go down, and I've never been there for a really proper outside ledge swell. And I know kind of what the numbers are. I was there for one day that was similar numbers, and it was big enough, but not crazy, but the wind was a little weird. So anyways, I knew like kind of that was my baseline. I was like, anything bigger than that, I think it could be worth it. And Parker and Benji were kind of talking, and Benji was like, oh, what do you think? I was like, it's borderline, like it's right there, but the conditions looked so good that I was like, let's just go. Like on the come up, we'll get it, and on the come down, we'll probably score. So we should just go. And I kind of just had this weird feeling that it was going to be a swell that was going to do something cool. So yeah, it was a little bit of just like an intuition call on that one, as far as like, and luckily like the crew at Tavarua had a little bit of space to let us sleep on cots. And they got us in. So it kind of all the stars aligned. And then that morning, the swell didn't really come up the evening before. So we didn't really know what to expect, but we'd gotten word, like Billy was talking to some of the crew down in South Oz. Or not South Oz, but like the South Coast,
yeah,
saying that the swell hit really pretty solid down there. So that was good. And then when we went out in the morning, it was high tide. And, but first thing we pulled up, and there's just this crazy set. Mark Visser got towed into it and got drained on like a little tow board. So we were all losing, and we're like, oh my God, it's on. Like it's big enough for sure. It was straight on the outside, not that weird, like cat and mouse size. And, yeah, we were just so excited, and it actually went really slow. There was no moorings to put the jet ski on. So I ran all the way back to the island on the ski and jumped on it on another one with someone who was coming out, and with KO, he gave me a ride back out. And by then everyone was out, and I just threw my vest on, grabbed my board and paddled straight out. And right as I jumped off the ski, there was kind of a first bigger set, and it almost caught everyone inside. No one got it, but it was a crazy wave. And then it was weird. It was kind of a little slow for a while. And we were all, I think, trying to figure out, like, is it getting bigger? Are we going to get caught inside? And then once it sort of, the tide went out and it settled in, and everyone got sort of like, okay, there's the spot, and these are what the waves are doing. It was just, that was on. And it was so perfect. I think that was what was crazy. Cause you know, you see a lot of the big waves, everyone surfs Jaws and stuff. It's like kind of windy and gnarly. And I mean, that to me, it was like, I felt like I was surfing 6 foot cloud break, but it was just on a whole nother scale out the back, and just as perfect. You were looking at the same thing. So yeah, it was really, really cool. And just a rad crew of people out too. Not because it was sort of an odd size of swell, not a bunch of people went as it was going to be like a big wave event. And then it kind of got big enough to be really special, and not a ton of people down there. So yeah, it was really fun just being out there hooting each other into waves. Like everyone was just screaming and losing their minds. It was so fun.
So funny that the guys who really know were there though, like you, Cole Christensen's, Billy Kempers. So yeah, those guys that really have their finger on the pulse of that joint, they still managed to be there and score, even though the forecast wasn't necessarily saying that. Like, what is the most challenging thing about that wave at that size? You mentioned the cat and mouse game. Holy shit. That is a sobering thought, wearing one of those on the head.
Yeah, well, luckily at that size, it sort of moved out onto the ledge and kind of like stacked. Once the tide went out, especially, it was kind of like stacked up in one spot pretty well. So it was pretty easy to not get caught inside. It's more when it gets like that 8 to 12 feet, is it breaks way in and then way out, and the out ones are kind of just mow you down if you want to sit on the inside. So it's like you can't get in and out fast enough. That's the unfortunate size. But then those guys were saying, when on those really big days, like the Volcom swell, that there were waves that would even break out like way further, and guys were getting smoked. So yeah, that would be a gnarly feeling. I mean, I've never worn the inflatable vest. That was the first time I'd worn one, but never used it. But that day was the first time that I'd ever actually pulled it. And it was definitely really nice to have. I'd say that probably the gnarliest part that day was the, like, if you didn't make a wave and you got clean, you got caught inside, the inside was nuts because it pushes in, and like Cloud Break never really has a channel. It kind of stops for a second, but then it just bends in and goes nuts. Like on the whole, it's like shish kebabs, all super shallow and sharp, and it's just gurgly and nasty. So that was probably the gnarliest. I got caught in there a couple of times with the thing blown up, and there's just these like 12-foot whitewash just and like detonating down there. But having that air in the wetsuit kept you from getting blown into the bottom and all scraped up. So I actually ended up not even getting cut, which was crazy. But the gnarliest thing was the guys driving the jet skis. They're freaking launching over coral heads and shit to get us out and then get back out. It was pretty crazy. Cause like I said, there's no real escape route. You kind of just have to wait it out. And when the tide's low, you can't go in. So they just would jump the whitewashes and then punch out. But it was pretty crazy, soupy. With no jet ski out there and you didn't make a wave, I don't know, you'd have to go all the way around the reef. You'd probably be able to catch two waves in a session. You'd be done.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. And just navigating that kind of terrain on a ski in aerated water. Oh, those guys are psycho. I actually can't fathom it. Though, like the, whether it's at Pipeline or at Cloudbreak or at Chopes, just the ability of those guys to safely navigate those kinds of cons on a jet ski is so tripped out to me.
Dude, it's insane. Yeah, it's definitely spooky getting on one of those things out there trying to save people. Oof.
Oh, so you were doing a bit of water patrol yourself.
I took Parker and Benji back out after we'd surfed all morning. We went in and then the swell kind of started to drop, but we went out and did step-offs for a while. So I drove those guys. I didn't even end up surfing because they didn't feel too comfortable driving the ski, and it was my friend's ski, so I just drove them the whole time. And so yeah, it had come down a bit. It wasn't as gnarly as driving in the morning, and the tide was a little higher. But yeah, I've definitely been out there a few times when it's kind of sticky situation, and you're like, man, you're getting just air, and you're like, oh my god, look at that thing coming at me.
Wow, that's so psycho. And talk us through some of your best waves out there, man. One thing as well, I was watching various edits of that session, I realized that the angle that you see looking into the barrel, it's actually like only a portion of the ride. Like it keeps going. Like some of Jai's ones, like he got barreled again, like through that kind of shish kebabs bit and just, you know, jumped off the back before the thing just would have absolutely killed him on the shish kebab section. But yeah, it's kind of longer than you realize, I think, from the footage.
And there was that day, there was really two types of waves. There was like these bigger, taller ones up off the top that we actually all could have been even further up the reef, but the current was really strong. It was really hard to paddle up there. But they would just be freight training down from super far up, and you could have even been up higher on those ones. So those were like the bigger drops and tubes, but then not as long of a tube. And then there was these like medium ones that would kind of come in and almost miss like that, the pack of guys that were sitting up there, but then they had longer lines on them and were like longer tubes. And I was kind of, I always remember that wave Hippo got and that swell, I think that was 2008 or maybe, I don't know. Yeah, maybe 2008 or something when Bruce got that wave. So I always wanted to get one of those really long ones. Those are always the waves I look for when it's like 6 feet on the inside ledge. So I was kind of hunting those, and it was a little tricky, like with the crowd and stuff, just sort of figuring it all out. And then, yeah, I didn't really get like the one big crazy one that I wanted to get, but I got one really fun long drainer that was like really memorable. It was probably the best tube I've ever had in my life. And it was actually, a lot of the boats were farther out. So this lady there wrote me and was like, I got your wave. And she sent it to me, but it wasn't really in any of the edits, which was kind of cool because I was trying to save our best clips for the snap part. So that, and then I did get one really fun, like big drop up off the top, and then was able to like get to, but wasn't super deep. So that was really fun, but it was just such a like memorable drop, just like, ooh, steep and such a cool feeling. And my first wave was just fun because it was kind of one of those really long lined up ones. And I got like a couple big pumps and just drained the thing. And then it went so fast, I got blown up, but it was nice to just get one and get pounded and then be like, okay, cool. I felt so good after that. Then I was kind of ready for anything. So yeah, it was so fun.
Those big ones that run off on you, What's the strategy there? Like, so I guess if you're falling further up the reef, it's a bit safer, right? You're not guaranteed to end up on the dry inside bit, or you still ended up in there?
It seemed like pretty much that day, no matter what, you ended up in the shit zone. But yeah, then there was a couple waves. Benji Brand got one. It was a big one and it had the crazy line on it. And that was the best wave, I think, that came in all day. My brother had a couple sick, big drops, and just so it was so cool to see it. Like those guys paddling up the shoulder on, you know, the face when one of your friends is taking off on just one of the best waves you've ever seen in your life. It's pretty surreal.
Was it Parker had a super crazy drop out there, like the craziest drop of the day, and you were basically watching it go down, like from
the shoulder? That was a sick drop. I was right there going over the shoulder. So cool.
What is that like, seeing your brother swing and send it that hard? Are you like screaming encouragement, or are you terrified?
A little of both. I was definitely, I think I was yelling pretty much as loud as I could yell. But then there was this one point he kind of got like a little bit on his heels and his nose almost looked like it was going to catch the outside. And I was just thinking, oh my God, please don't fall. And then he got it and his board like grabbed the face of the wave and he just went woof and pulled up into the tube. And I was like, oh, thank you for not falling right there. I was also going with the face of the wave on Billy's wipeout when he freaking did like an air reverse off a 15 footer. That was psycho. I thought for sure he broke his leg or something. I was tripping.
Yeah. It's so interesting, Billy's approach to waves of that kind of consequence. Like, he just seems to lock in, and once he's locked in and committed, like there's no turning back. It's a done deal, even if the thing doubles up and ledges as hard as that one did.
Yeah, he's freaking Billy charges so hard. That was psycho. That was actually one of those waves. No one was really in the good spot for it. Like, you could have taken off so far up the reef on that wave. And there's a couple guys that looked like they're going to go and they didn't. And Billy just whipped it. He was like, I had to just try. So I think in his mind, he knew he wasn't in the best spot, but the wave was just so good that he just said, he's like, I had to try to take off on that thing. It was so,
That's even crazier. Like that wave was caught on the back of guys pulling back. And that's always a bit of a false start. Like, if guys balk, then you've generally not committed as hard as you could have. But
yeah, so, like, it was only one of those just woof, like boom, like couple paddles and just, oh, it was so nuts.
God, what a maniac. That is psycho. And what does it look like inside one of those things?
It's so perfect. It's pretty crazy. Because it's such a cloud break, always has such a long line on it. The best ones sometimes look like closeouts, and sometimes you don't make them, and then sometimes you make them. And it's just the same out there, but bigger. So sometimes the waves that they looked good, but they wouldn't have enough wall. And then the best ones are just like, ooh, super lined up. And then I was like, I didn't make one or two that I was too deep on or something, but then they're so big and blue, and it's trippy out there too. We were all saying from that boat angle, when you see the footage, it doesn't look like you're that deep in the tube a lot, but when you're riding those waves, that the top of the lip looks like it's so far out, but the way the lip line is, it's like so tapered. So then it's actually like hitting back, you know, so from the side angle, it doesn't look like you're that deep. It's weird, but I swear when you're out there, you feel like you're super deep in the tube, or even when you're paddling out, you could see the foam balls like right there. So it's crazy. I don't know. It's a little bit deceiving the way it works at cloud break. If you see it straight on, you're really deep.
Mate, I'm glad you made that distinction, because the only footage you ever see is looking into the barrel. And yeah, you don't really get a sense of how deep people are. But then you see photos, like you see the odd GoPro clip, or I've seen stuff. I don't know if it's been shot in the pit looking out by a photographer or whatever, but I've seen that perspective a few times, and it's like, oh no, these guys are deep. Like,
yeah, totally. It's super trippy. I don't know. It's like the lip throws so far out that way, but then it hits so far, you know, it's like this weird tapered lip angle or something that's kind of different.
Interesting. And I guess you guys are traveling at light speed, so however far the lip throws out, like you're covering so much ground on big wave guns that they're like quad guns, that it's all a bit of an optical Illusion. Mate, congrats on that. What a way to kick off your free surfing career. Like you couldn't have done it any better.
Thanks, yeah, I'm stoked. That was just such a cool day to be a part of.
Mate, take us back to the early days. Obviously, you grew up in that kind of Santa Barbara region, and holy smokes, like what a time to be a Grom. You know, you had Dane Reynolds, a few years older than you, Bobby Martinez, Curran is still doing laps of Rincon. Yeah, what were those days like? Like that must have been mind melting for a frothing teenage surfer.
Oh yeah, it was so insane. I mean, we had a really cool surf scene when I was growing up. I mean, I still think it's cool, but it was, there was more like local pro surfers, you know, also intermixed with all of those guys, you know? So there's obviously Dane and Tom and Bobby were probably like three, obviously the three biggest names that have probably come out of our area. But then we had so many other guys like, you know, Chris Brown, Petey Musio and Tar Khashoggi and, you know, I don't know, like the Brian Moore, and there's just a ton of really good surfers around. And on any given day, like anytime Rincon was good, they'd all be out. So that was always really, really cool to see. I mean, there was tons of good surfing going on. So yeah, then it was funny that between, there wasn't really anyone just older than us that my brother and I that wanted to be or kind of became pro surfers. So it was sort of an interesting gap. And then kind of funny, there's sort of been another gap after us. I don't know. It's, there's just not waves here that often. I trip out on it actually now that I've, you know, kind of had my career and I'm here now going, wow, it's amazing that you could get good at surfing living here with how little wave quality we have compared to when I go down to Australia or something, or you spend time in Hawaii and you see the kids coming up there and they're just, boom, there's waves every day. Like D-ball always has waves. So it's, yeah, it's super interesting. It definitely makes you really hungry to surf when you're from here, I think. So I always thought that was the benefit that came out of that. It's like, yeah, you don't have the most consistent waves, but when there's waves, you're just super jones. And then anytime you went somewhere where the waves were consistent, it was such a treat. So yeah, but I mean, no shortage of talent of surfers around here, and getting to see Tom Curran surf Rincon in real life when you're a little kid is super, super inspiring. I used to just trip out because he'd always kind of show up inconspicuously and no one would really know. And sometimes he'd be on some random board with no logos and in a hood. And all of a sudden you'd see him flying down the wave on a wave at Rincon. He'd be like, oh my God, there's Tom again, just ripping. And then obviously Dane was, I mean, in my opinion, Dane was the best surfer in the world there for a handful of years, hands down. And to get to go, I surfed with Dane a bunch when I was a kid. I mean, I remember being out at some of the beach breaks where it'd just be him and me and maybe one or two other guys out and getting to talk to him and, you know, being 14 and getting to surf and talk to your favorite surfer in the whole world and be out there with no one else out. Like, that's insane. And then Bobby too. I mean, Bobby, those are my three favorite surfers growing up and they were all from my area, which is pretty crazy. I love like Andy and Taylor Knox too, but for sure those three were like my favorite. I love Tom's style and everything about his surfing, but then like Bobby's backside and then Dane's just like raw approach, it was like if I could figure out how to mold all those together, it was, that was, so I just could pull so much inspiration from seeing them around. Not that I ever came close to molding any of their surfings together, but It was just like they're also, and Bobby's such a fucking cool guy and was always so great to Parker and I, like they all were great to us. And you know, it's really cool, like Bobby's still, I talk to him all the time. And you know, just cool that, you know, we all just love to surf. And I think it's sometimes we don't all surf together because it's kind of crowded and everyone's doing their own thing. But anytime that we get to all be in the water together is really cool.
Oh, man, I disagree. I feel like you really did mold Curran and Dane surfing together in particular. Like, I kind of see you as the bastard child of those two approaches. Like, you know, you've got that raw aggression of Dane, and but then like this ability just goes super hard at sections and steez out of it, keep your speed, not overcommit, like kind of really flow down the line amazingly. Did you study those guys a lot? Like, were you able to you know, pinpoint certain aspects in their technique and try to adopt them?
Oh yeah, I mean, I freaking searching for Tom Curran was probably the first movie that I was just, you know, obsessed with trying to figure out what he was doing. I remember my dad surfs, but he was never a you know, a good surfer in terms of, you know, what we all think of, you know, he just loved it. But when we got super into it, he wanted to help us get better. So he was like, okay, Tom Curran, like, here's searching for Tom Curran. And he was like, Tom has the best bottom turn. And so he would play it and we'd freaking watch his bottom turn just over and over and over again. And I remember a few times my dad just being like, okay, you guys just go out and try bottom turns, you know, and shitty closed out beach break, but we'd be out there trying to do the best bottom turn we could do. So yeah, I mean, we, from a pretty young age, Parker and I were already trying to like really analyze and study surfing and try to figure out how to get better. And then, you know, we worked with Brad Gerlach too for a lot of years there. And Brad is such a wizard at technique and figuring out all the little intricacies of surfing. And a lot of it's kind of counterintuitive sometimes and like trying to figure out how to do something. And he had it so wired. So that was really fun. Like kind of, we had the passion and like the want to learn that stuff. And then Brad had a lot of the pieces to the puzzle. So that was really cool. But yeah, I mean, I used to watch Dane, Bobby and Tom surf all the time on video. And then, you know, also like Andy and Taylor Knox too, I think were other guys I loved, but for sure those three were my nonstop. I was always trying to watch their parts and just figure out how to do what the fuck they were doing.
Man, the style pedigree that you're running is absolutely peerless. Like having obviously Karen and Dane as real life muses as a kid growing up, and then working with Gert, another incredible technician, incredible style master, and interesting too, like your dad giving you that advice to just repetitively try bottom turns on shitty closeout days. That's like the Wave Key program in a nutshell, you know, like not in a nutshell, there's so much more to it than that, but so much of what Gert teaches is like, yeah, you know, just practice a fundamental maneuver. Whether it's a frontside or backside takeoff or frontside or backside bottom turn. And you can do that on the worst possible days.
Totally. We'd literally go out. I remember being at St. Clemente Pier down there for nationals and I just got smoked, like first time ever being down there. And I was like, well, just go out and try bottom turns. We're just trying bottom turns at shitty closed out St. Clemente Pier. So funny.
Man, I remember when you're a junior too in Bali watching it's still one of the best heats I can remember watching. And you know, I covered the world tour for years and I've watched 1,000 CT level heats, but yeah, it was you and Andrew Doheny in the final at, I think it was
Chengdu, right? Wasn't it? I think it was a semi-final actually, because Andrew ended up making the final. I lost to him in the semi. Yeah.
Oh man, you guys were just going toe to toe, blow for blow on these head high rippable rights. And it was just like, holy shit. It was like that pinnacle of raw teenage power surfing and progressive surfing. Amazing to watch.
Thank you. No, that was fun. I was really good buddies with Andrew at the time. And we'd been hanging a bunch that event. And so, of course, you end up surfing against each other always when you're doing that. But we were stoked. We were both in the semis. And I think we both just, you know, we were fired up to already have made it that far. And Andrew is such a good surfer, you know, he still is, but that was just fun. You know, anytime you get I think that's what I love the most about competing is when you get in those heats where you're with someone else and you're really just like going at it back and forth and the waves are fun and there's a lot of opportunity. Like I think that's the raddest part about surf contests. And it's always harder when it's inconsistent and slow and maybe you get one wave in a heat or something and then it comes down to a tactical kind of, or maybe luck, you know, a lot of it's luck, but those heats when you're just getting opportunity and you're going back and forth is so fun.
Mm. And, you know, CT, the world tour is often sold to us as the creme de la creme, the peak of professional performance surfing. But I find that at that level, that the world juniors, the Challenger Series that's currently on, man, there's a level of spontaneity and excitement and unpredictability in the surfing that's actually really refreshing to watch.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, there's something I think sometimes people, you know, the tour almost maybe dictates a little bit of what surfing happens there or something. I don't know, something changes. Whereas what you said, when people are just kind of fresh on the scene and there's no like, oh, this or that, it's just boom, this is my surfing and I'm going to let it rip. And I think there's something like really raw and cool about that. And it's it's probably the best approach to have on the CT too, but yeah, it is. It's really fun to see that and just, you know, more guys and just a lot less to lose maybe or something. I don't know. It's like, just, I'm going to let it all hang out there, and that's good.
Yeah, that's so true. I've been loving Dakota Walters on the Challenger Series in this event and in the regional qualifiers too. He's a classic example of that. Just a raw, rangy kid with all the technical wizardry. And then he's got an amazing rail game, and he's trying to mold himself into a competitor, and watching him try and build that consistent repertoire out of this super hi-fi, explosive, but stylish brand of surfing is just a fun thing to watch. Like, he's not there yet. He hasn't reached that kind of CT level of consistency. And like you said, at that level, it demands a level of consistency. It dictates a kind of brand of surfing that is obviously amazing as well. But, you know, they're both brands are amazing. Mate, as well, like, your family's really interesting too. Like, so I remember you telling me your uncle, Jason Baffa, one of the great surf filmmakers, like, you know, he's up there with your Thomas Campbells and Andrew Kidman's, he made Single Fin Yellow, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Single Fin Yellow, One California Day. And then he made the film about Italy too, Bella Vita.
Right. Yeah, man. Tell us a bit about Jason. I mean, the Single Fin Yellow is an incredible concept. One of the great surf films.
Yeah, thanks. No, he'd love to hear that. Yeah, Jason actually is sometimes I told him this recently, that he doesn't get enough credit for getting Parker and I into surfing as he should. He got my dad they got into surfing at a similar time. My dad was going to college at UCLA, and then Jason was living out. My dad and mom were together. So they became really good friends. Jason's a lot younger than my mom, 9 years, I think. And so my dad would pick Jason up and take him surfing all the time. Anyways, fast forward way later, Jason was really into surfing and already like sort of getting into filmmaking stuff. And he was really influential in us getting out for the first time and then continuing to surf. He made these like longboard skateboards that we'd ride, and he'd always give us, like, he gave me my first surf movies, I think Endless Summer, and just, you know, kind of planted some seeds in there and got us stoked on surfing from a super young age, and then always sort of nurtured it along. And he was probably one of the first people, I mean, I knew not too much about surfing, but that sort of implanted like style into my head, as far as like, you know, because longboarding is so much about, you know, style and grace and like little movement. So I longboarded more because Jason longboarded. So when I first started surfing, I was mostly longboarding for a lot of years and riding single fins and just random shit. But yeah, it was just interesting to go back to that, you know, and just sort of some of those really early influences I had in surfing are all from Jason. So yeah.
It's interesting how starting your surfing on big boards, they require you to read waves really well to get speed, and that also forces you to kind of use less movement of the body, and these are like fundamental technique aspects that, you know, there was a time when everyone learned on boards that were too big for them. And those days are kind of gone. And a lot of people credit that kind of learning arc with creating the styles that are inimitable, you know, your Ockies, your Bruces, your Tajes, your Parkos, your Mix. Like, these guys also come from a similar trajectory to you. Like, yeah, what can you say about the importance of starting your surfing on these kinds of clunkier, longer, more archaic pieces of equipment?
Yeah, I think it's super important. I mean, I see kids all the time now who are just learning how to surf, and they stand up, like literally getting pushed into waves, and they stand up, and then if they're on a small enough board, they just start hopping. And because they can, you know, the board can do that. Whereas if you learn on a longboard or a, you know, some big clunky board, you can't do that. So you learn to just sort of stand there and glide, and then use the subtle nuances, like you're really talking about, is you can turn a board by barely doing anything. You don't have to move your arms. You don't have to hop up and down. You know, all you really have to do is move weight from your heel to your toes, or from your toes to your heel, you know, to turn the other way. So I think inherently you learn how to do that a little bit easier when you're on a big board from a young age, and you can't bounce around, hop around, you can't try airs. Like, I just didn't even grow up here, you know, doing that. I rode these bigger boards and would just kind of cruise. So I think that obviously molds your surfing a lot, because you learn to kind of hold your arms a certain way, you learn to stand a certain way, and then it sort of all unfolds from that, and reading the waves and all that. So yeah, it's really interesting for sure. I mean, now you see, I just took Jackson Dorian down to Salina Cruz, or not Salina Cruz, but like Barra area for 3 days to surf. And he's so classic. He had pull up so many kids on his phone to show me surfing. And I couldn't believe, it's like, I haven't even heard of any of these kids, and they're so gnarly. But there was kids who are like 11 years old from Brazil doing like full rotators, like ripping so hard. I couldn't even believe it. It's just crazy.
I guess that's the flip side of not learning on big clunky pieces of equipment. The modern generation, their ability in the air is mind melting. It's hard to fathom.
Yeah, it's so crazy. And then it was cool to talk, you know, because Jackson's 17, I'm 30. So we have a pretty big age gap. You know, he's sort of in a whole new generation of coming up and surfing, you know, coming up with Instagram and coming up with wave pools and this whole, all these things that these kids have now that I did not have when I grew up surfing. You know, it's just so different. It's just crazy how different it is. But yeah, that the air game is nuts. Like, I just didn't, when I grew up, I didn't even think about it really, you know. Airs kind of became a thing as I was like a teenager. It's like, oh, cool. You know, I started seeing Dane and these guys doing airs. But I remember one time at Rincon, this guy came hopping down the line on a wave, and this guy looked at me, he's all crusty. He's all, yeah, you're supposed to shoot the hopper. And I was like, what? He's all, yeah, you don't hop or you get shot. And I was like, oh, okay. I don't know why it just stuck with me. The random thing, but one of those weird things when you're a kid. I was like, okay, I guess I'm not supposed to hop.
Love that. That's hilarious, man. And your family also, they had a parcel at the ranch. Is that right?
Yeah, we have for a little while.
Well, what's the deal with that joint? I don't really know a whole lot about it. I mean, I've read like snippets in the Surfers Journal, but I understand like Yvonne Chouinard has a parcel, and it's like a, I don't know if maybe Greeno had a bit there as well, but yeah, what's the deal with that joint?
The ranch has been around forever. I mean, it's an old cattle ranch on like the Gaviota coast. So yeah, I mean, it's divided up into, I don't even know how many parcels, but then those parcels are divided up into different pieces too. So we don't have a whole parcel, but yeah, I mean, it's just a really special stretch of coastline, and just like it when you go there, because it's not densely populated, you know, they've made like really, I guess, over the years requirements on what you could build. So there's not a lot of structures, and there's not a lot of public access to like the land. Beach has, you can still walk up, but so it's pretty untouched. It's really raw and rural, and it just looks like, to me, how I'd imagine California being probably like, you know, a few hundred years ago, which is pretty special. You know, I think it looks like probably when the Chumash lived here almost, which is pretty insane. But yeah, it's just it's a pretty great stretch of coastline from there. I mean, really from when you get past Santa Barbara, like from the Gaviota coast starts like just outside of Goleta all the way up to Central California, just those like rolling hills and, you know, just old kind of quintessential California, you know, you got like Halama all through Vandenberg Air Force Base up and past that. Like, it's pretty insane, all that whole zone. Really pretty.
Right. And obviously, man, we mentioned at the top of the program about, you know, the heights of your World Tour career, and it was, yeah, like really solid. And competing at Trestles in that final five, you beat Morgan Sibley, you lost to Philippe Toledo, and it's just down the road, you know. Well, not just down the road, but, you know, it's a wave that you would have been very familiar with and a part of the world you're very familiar with. Yeah, talk to us about that experience, man. What are your memories from that? Is there anything you'd change?
Oh, man, I'm great. I mean, such great memories. I always loved competing at Trestles. It was sad when they got rid of that on the CT in general, because it was so fun to have a CT on California soil, you know, and it was probably the closest thing it felt to like a home event, you know, just because it was here, and always knew a bunch of people, and all the, you know, California crew would rally, my family could come down and stuff. So it was sad when they got that off the regular schedule. But yeah, I mean, doing the being a part of that first finals event was really cool. And I was just stoked. Like that year, I had had good performances on the CT, like you even mentioned, you know, my rookie year making quarters against Mick. Like, you know, I beat Mick and Jordy in a heat at Bell's that day, and then got to serve against Mick in the quarters, and like I almost got the score I needed. Actually, it was a sick heat, but
that heat was sick. It was like you were both cashing in 16 plus point totals. I think you lost by less than a point to Fanning at Bell's.
Yeah,
a crazy thing to pull off in your rookie year.
It was rad. I mean, I think back now to when like kind of my run on tour, I got to surf against all the guys that I looked up to like my whole life, you know, pretty much. I mean, not Tom and Dane and Bobby. I know it would have been really cool to be there with those guys, but you know, the Joels and Mix and Kelly and Taj was there my rookie year, you know? And, you know what I mean? Like Adriana, like these guys who were there for a really long time, Bede, and you know, there's a whole group of guys that I'm forgetting. Ace, like Ace did the tour for so long. And so guys that had so much experience and that I've been watching on tour for so long that it felt coming in there as, you know, like a 22, 23 year old with not any experience on the CT was pretty crazy. So it felt really hard to beat those guys at times, you know? And I think anytime a rookie beat one of those guys was kind of a big deal. And fast forward to now, everyone's so much younger. And I feel like everyone just boom, 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 like Cole winning, you know, it's like, okay, cool, rookie, boom, he won. Like, and I'm not discounting anything of that. He's serving insane, but it's just, there's not as many of the guys that have been staples on tour for like 10 to 15 years right now that have so much experience. So I think it was really, I mean, I'm super stoked that I got to surf on there with all those guys. And yeah, but I never got to really crack. I finished seventh one year, and then, you know, I'd have a couple good events, but didn't really put a good year together. So I always had in my mind, I was like, I think if I can get some of these things to line up, you know, I think I could be up there in the top five and be sick to get to go for a world title. So to get to have that chance at Trestles here on home turf was super special.
Did you end up getting rookie of the year? You got that fifth at Bell's, a runner up at Portugal.
I Kyo did good. I think he ended up with it. I needed to make one more heat at Pipe, and I lost to Kelly in round three by like 0.07.
Oh, that's heavy. Yeah. Wow, that's so classy. Trip. And that trip I mentioned at the start of the program too, it was yourself, Kyle Belly was on that trip, Ian Gentile and Jack Robinson. And it was interesting, I was forced to make predictions about where you guys would end up in the ensuing articles that were published in Stable Surfing or whatever. And they all kind of panned out exactly correct. Like I thought Kyle was a guarantee to get to the CT because of his work ethic and grit. I thought you were obviously going to face a tough choice of whether to pursue the CT or free surfing. I thought Jack had shocked the world if he could develop a strong rail game. And I thought Ian might not get there because he kind of lacked the work ethic that you guys had. And it did actually take Ian Gentile a long time to get to the tour, but he got there and, you know, he's been cut. But so interesting.
That'd be sick to dig that out and actually like read it.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And so interesting that Kyo just got the nod over you. That's I didn't remember that. Yeah, you guys were amazing to watch at that age, man. Like, it was crazy how mature your surfing was. I remember I think we went up to the Tellos, and I remember watching you surf this right that was maybe even in Searching for Tom Curran, ironically. And you ripped this crazy, perfectly positioned hook in the bowl that become a Hurley advertisement that Jimmy Cain shot. And I just remember watching it in the flash, and it just sent a jolt of electricity through the whole boat. And, you know, Jimmy was freaking out. And yeah, it's just an amazing thing to be a part of. And to just know that you guys were all on this trajectory of greatness, but you were at such a raw and fun age. And it was just a funny trip. Fuck, man. I was 22. I was an absolute reprobate, somehow put in charge of like some trip. I mean, I was an idiot. I couldn't tie my shoelaces together. It was a miracle we all got out of it alive, but fuck, we had some laughs.
Oh, we had such a good time. Yeah, I was just telling someone about that trip the other day, actually. So fun. I think I went on one trip before that with Tom Carey down to Mexico, and then that was like the first kind of bigger international trip that I got to do for a magazine and stuff. I was so excited.
And yeah, so fast forwarding back to Trestles and so what was that experience like in terms of like the lead into it and how you manage the pressure and it was obviously the pinnacle of your competitive career and you surfed really well in the event too.
Thank you. Yeah, the lead up was, I mean, that was an interesting year because it was kind of that COVID year. So it'd been like full on the tour. You know, we did like a couple months in Australia between the quarantine and then I think three or four events down there on the road. And then we were supposed to have, I'd been doing well. And then we were supposed to have, we went to Barra and then we were supposed to go to Tahiti. And I made the quarters at Barra and I just lost. And I remember like, oh, damn it. Like I needed to do it, you know, make another couple of heats to like have a better spot going into Tahiti just in case, you know, to be in the top five or whatever. And then I went to bed that night. I think we kind of partied that night, actually. I remember waking up kind of hungover in the morning and getting all these messages like Tahiti's canceled. And I was like, what? Tahiti's canceled? That sucks. Cause I love Tahiti and I wanted to go back so bad. And then someone wrote me, it was like, oh, you're in the top five for sure. And I was like, really? I hadn't done all the math or anything or knew that what I needed to do or anything. So I just knew that I needed to do good at Tahiti too. But yeah, I guess whatever, since certain people had lost the day before in Barra and like whoever was left in the contest couldn't pass me, I like made it. So anyways, I was stoked. It was cool. And then, it was fun just getting down. I went down to Lowers. My brother came down. We just surfed our brains out for like a couple weeks and, got ready for the event. And it was so fun to have, all four of my grandparents came down, which was really special. I had my parents and a bunch of my like friends and like Dave Latinsky, who's been, he works for Sex Facts, but has been taking care of my brother and I, helping us in surfing since we were like 6 years old. He was down there with his sons that I grew up surfing with. So just to have all those people and my family and everyone on the beach was just so special. And surprisingly emotional too. I'd never really gotten emotional ever paddling out for a heat surfing, but I remember feeling that day was super special and really fun. And yeah, getting to surf a couple heats. I almost had Felipe. I like started out the heat so good. And then I kind of made one mistake and then he just freaking got the score at the end. Cause he's a freak. He's so good. So yeah, it was so fun. Super memorable. Like those are, I mean, I really enjoy competing. I do. And, those times when you're getting to surf against the best surfers in the world at on a stage like that is really cool. And just to think learning to deal with like, you know, all those what could be pressures and in situations like that, and train your mind to just block that out and enjoy being there and doing what you love to do and trying to bring your best is just, it's a really cool challenge. And I enjoyed that about competing a lot.
Yeah, it's a bit of a superpower too that I'm sure translate into ordinary life. And I can imagine how emotional you were. It would have been amazing to be surrounded by that kind of love and support, having all four grandparents there. Incredible, in your home state. What a moment.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean, just to feel that, because most of the time traveling, like my parents came to a couple events over the years and stuff, but most of the time I'm out with, you know, whatever, like someone who is coaching me or Perry, like my friend, and competing in somewhere like Brazil or somewhere where they don't want you to do good, you know, or, you know, Australians were always great to me, but it's not like having your home crowd, you know, behind you. So, just to feel that love and that support was really special for sure.
And then so crazy, a few months later and you cut from tour, and yeah, there's something that doesn't sit well with me about the fact that surfers can be cut so quickly after challenging for a world title. Like, I just can't think of many sports where that happens, in particular, given how average though that start to tour can be waves wise. it's not, it's a long way from the Dream Tour in those first five events. We've just seen how bad it can get. Wow. It was barely watchable. You know, Sunset had moments, Pipe had moments, but Portugal, Bells and Margs were super mediocre events. And it's interesting too, you mentioned how, you know, in your time on tour, you were surfing against these veterans who'd been there for 10 plus years. And I think that now, like, it's almost impossible for people to have that kind of tenure on tour. The format kind of prevents that from happening. Like, if I think back to, you know, there was surely times, if you looked at the ratings, where your Parkos, Mix, Tajes, Beads, whoever you want to name, were not inside the top 25 after five events. I haven't fact checked I'm sure of
that'd
it.
Be interesting. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it is really, it was such a bizarre feeling for sure to go from being at the, you know, like you said, the pinnacle of my competitive career to then going, holy shit, am I really not going to be fucking requalify? Like, what the fuck? You know, it was so bizarre. And I'd been there for a while. So, you know, I'd had times before where I wasn't doing well on tour either. Like my rookie year, even I got a good result and then I like went cold for quite a few events and I needed to get a result at the last event to requalify. And then I got second. And, you know, had that been a mid-year cut year, I would have fallen off tour. Who knows if I ever would have even gotten back on tour, you know, and then I wouldn't have been on there for 7 years or finished in the fourth or seventh. So it's super interesting. And, you know, I guess anytime something changes so drastically, it feels weird, right? Like in life, you know, you're like, wait, it was like that and now it's like this. So I think part of it probably is a little bit of that. You know, if this was always normal, we wouldn't maybe think as oddly of it, but I do think I agree. I mean, I think it's strange that you could go from being in the top five or contending for a world title and then the next year after five events being cut back to the qualifying series. And I think just for me, at where I was in my life, I just didn't really feel like I had the concentration to compete on the qualifying series again to get back on the CT. Like if I was still on the CT, I would have done it for a couple more years because I was having fun, loving it. It's funny. I felt like at that point when I did not requalify, I was getting better at surfing. I was like surfing better than I had the year before that I finished fourth. And I was so excited I was like, man, I think I could even do better than fourth, you know? So it was so strange, but surfing is really weird like that. Those first five events for me, just, I like couldn't get things to go my way. I was like, just at Pipe, freaking, I had the first heat of the day against Baron, and Baron's gnarly out there and the waves were terrible. Like it was so slow. And then it got so good. And I was just sitting there going, oh my God, it's just firing now. And then like Sunset, Kyle got a freaking nine right at the end and beat me, you know? And I had like, I think I had 15 or 16 points. And then Portugal, I got fifth. And then Bells, like I was surfing for my spot on tour at like waist high onshore Winky Pop. Whoa. And I was like, this is the second day. I think it was the first or second day of the waiting period. And they were running heats and like the worst waves. And I just couldn't wrap my head around it. I was like, this is so strange. And then Margaret's, it was like huge and stormy. And I barely lost a Griffin. And I was like, well, that's it. Now I'm back on the QS. But it's crazy. I mean, I think surfing, there's just so many moments in heats where it's like one little thing goes your way or doesn't. And, you know, in five events, if you have two or three of those, then, you know, you don't really get a chance to showcase your surfing or your ability. Or like, I didn't even feel like I barely got to surf in those five events. Felt like I barely even rode waves. So weird. It was the weirdest feeling.
Yeah. And then being sent back to the Challenger series, it's almost worse. It's almost a worse outcome being sent back there than having never been on the world tour in a sense. Like you look at Morgs now and, you know, incredible rookie year, makes the final five, loses, goes back to the Challenger series. Can't get back on the world tour because it's just so emotionally destabilizing. And also the actual nature of Challenger Series contests, like as entertaining as they are to watch when the waves are good, they're a total crapshoot. It's four man heats. It's like you talk about those little moments that come up and potentially pass you by at the elite level in man-on-man heats. In the four-man variety, those little windows are even more finite. The wins and losses are, it's just an emotional roller coaster down there. And there's absolutely no guarantee, no matter who you are and how good you surf, that when you go back there, that you're going to be able to manage the psychological aspect of being sent back to that intense arena.
Yeah, it's full on. I mean, and it really, I think that's just, it really takes that just full commitment to the Challenger Series. And you just have to like, just strip it down and just be like, fuck, I'm going to do this, you know, but you have to have that and you have to be super hungry and you have to want it really bad. And I got to that point when I was 21, 22, that I felt that way and I made it happen. But for me at this stage, I wasn't really able to get back in that headspace. You know, I was like, I kind of want to do all these other things in my surfing and career and life. So, you know, it's just interesting to, I think it really is. It's a young, it makes it more of a young life sport right now, the way that it is. Cause it's just a constant, like if you're off the CT, then you're on the Challenger Series. And well, if you're off the Challenger Series, you're on the regionals and then blah, 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 blah. It's just crazy. I mean, you don't know what your life's going to look like for a few months, you know, and from a monetary standpoint with your sponsors to a travel standpoint to coaches to like, everything's just like out the window. It's crazy.
Wow. When you put it like that, it's insanity. That's absolute chaos. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. And like, it's just a, yeah, it is such a brutal reality check. And they talk a lot about, you know, in sports in particular, the zone of proximal development. When you hear people talk about, oh, he's in the zone, that's what they're talking about. It's the zone of proximal development. And that is the intersection on a graph of like physical and mental progress, and where it intersects is the zone. And
yeah,
you kind of have to stay in that zone, or you want to be in that zone to, I think this is a Jordan Peterson rant, but you want to be in that zone because that's kind of where you have to be to succeed at the level you guys are at. And then on top of that, when you're not in the zone, you're depressed because you're no longer growing, you're going backwards. And so stepping back onto the Challenger Series after a World Tour career, having just spent your life trying to achieve a goal and just having it so briefly before getting it ripped away, like you're going back there a bit demoralized, and that demoralization just gets amplified if you're not totally in the zone on the Challenger Series. There's no way you're winning heats. I just watched Callum Robson get knocked from the event. I think he's maybe not the defending champ, but the last time he was in the event, he won it.
Yeah, he won the event. He won the event the year that I got cut off the tour. He won.
That's right.
Yeah.
And now he can't get past the round of 32. He's fresh off the World Tour where he was a force on there, and now he's like battling again. It's mate, yeah, it's a grind at the moment. I do feel for guys in that kind of situation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think hopefully it sort of all works itself out. I think it's probably just feels weird right now because it's a new whole, everything's changed and everything's different. But you know, I think the idea that the Challenger Series hopefully gets elevated and then there's more good surfing happening there, and like you were saying, you know it's just as maybe more entertaining to watch this event than it was the last couple CT events, you know. And if the eyeballs on those grow, and hopefully it does, then that, you know, is better for all the surfers on the Challenger Series. And yeah, maybe it helps it grow, I don't know, maybe it doesn't, but we'll see.
It's such a good point. As long as they can get the Challenger Series in really quality waves, like the waves make contests. If the waves are awful, no one's going to watch. But as long as there's quality waves on that Challenger Series, there's absolutely no reason why it can't, reach a level akin to the World Tour just because of the excitement factor, the amount of waves being ridden, and that brand of surfing that's on show. It is a quality product. Man, moving forward in your life, you've also got a podcast, which is sick. And before I let you go, I just wanted to hear a few of the highlights from this journey and throw a bit of publicity the way of the cold beer. What is it? The 805
Surf Club.
Cold beer. That's it. Man, there's some sick episodes on there. What's been some of the highlights and favorite guests from that journey?
Well, yeah, it's fun. I mean, I never really imagined being able to host a podcast. I like to talk, but I've never been super gifted with gab. But, you know, once I get going on stuff that I'm passionate about, I love it. And connecting with people that, you know, have shared passions is always really fun. So that was the goal with it, is to start something with 805 and to just connect with people that love to surf, but, you know, maybe aren't pro surfers. That was like the goal, was more just that people that love to surf but are like super passionate and skilled at other things, and kind of see what you know, what that intersection looks like. Why do they love surfing? Like, what's it mean in their life? Because I think that's what I've been really interested with in all my travels and journeys around. It's like, there's people that love to surf from so many different walks of life from all over the world, whether they're, you know, I don't know, musicians or surfers or chefs or so it's all sorts of different people. And so, yeah, that's sort of the goal with the podcast, is just to bring those like-minded people out and hear their stories and connect on surfing and what it means to them. So, yeah, I guess I always, you know, I grew up looking up to Chris Malloy a lot and just talking story with him around here on the beach. So it was sick to get to sit with him. We hang out quite a bit, and you know, I know his family and stuff. So that was really fun. And they've all been super fun, like all different. And you know, obviously my brother, that's easy. We could sit there and talk shit for hours, days, probably. Sage was super well-spoken and really fun to talk about. We're kind of at like a little bit similar places in our lives. So that was fun and interesting. And we did the tour for a lot of years together, and actually grew up competing in NSSA around this area and hanging out down at the US Open and stuff together. So that was cool. And Chris Shiflett is, I was actually the first victim on his podcast, and, you know, he's an insane guitar player, loves to surf and travels the world in the Foo Fighters. So yeah, I think that's all the ones we've done so far. It's been fun, and I'm excited to, you know, get some more people on there, and just kind of a fun project, I think, while I was home and not on the road as much, to kind of dive in and just talk to people about, you know, shared life passions and stuff.
Amazing, mate. Well, congrats on an incredible surfing career that's still going, and looking forward obviously to the birth of your child. It's amazing, man. It seems like you're in an actually awesome place in life right now, with plenty of passion projects on the go, and a really fun next chapter of traveling the world with your brother coming up.
Thanks, Jed. No, I'm fired up, and just lucky and grateful to still be getting to make a living surfing. That's the dream, and hopefully keep doing it for a few years.
Dick, mate. Well, thanks so much for your time, and
anytime, dude. Good to catch up. Where are you living these days?
Mate, I'm up in the consistent surf capital of the globe, the northeast coast of Australia, just an hour south of the Goldie. And you mentioned, mate, the consistency of waves up here is mind-blowing. There's almost never not waves.
I know. When I was last year when I didn't make it, I was thinking about freaking trying to get a place down there and spending like half the year in Australia, just because I love it down there so much. It's so fun.
Mate, it wouldn't be a bad
idea. Might still do it someday.
Yeah, there's Paddy Goudang's on the headland here, just north of me. Yeah, there's some crew making the move from the States. You're always welcome down here, mate. You're welcome on Smithy's couch.
Oh, thanks, dude. Yeah, well, I'll for sure be back down next year. We'll have to hang.
Fucking oath. All right, bro. Thank you so much.
Anytime, dude. Thanks for having me on.
Speak to you, brother. See you, mate.
Later.